the CBS News Weekend Roundup in 60 seconds.
In business, risks and rewards come with every decision, like moving to the cloud with Office 365. While its benefits include anywhere access and lower costs, cyber threats and user errors can quickly wipe out data and the money you save. Barracuda Essentials for Office 365 provide an added layer of security and functionality for threat protection, email migration, data recovery, and quality of service. Move securely to Office 365. Visit barracuda.com/essentials to learn more.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup, a wrap-up of the week with background and analysis from the correspondents who cover the news. And now from Washington, here's CBS News national correspondent Dan Rabin.
The battle for the nominations to run for president became more bitter, triggered by victories for the second-place candidates in both parties, Ted Cruz and Bernie Sanders, in Wisconsin. That sure didn't sit well with Donald Trump and with Hillary Clinton. They are heavily favored in New York's primary a week from Tuesday on the 19th. But you'll hear CBS News contributor Bob Schieffer musing.
I'm beginning to wonder, are these political parties going to survive 2016?
A lot more from Bob coming up, and
I'm proud to be a
the death of Merle Haggard, a big loss to country music, and a lot more on this weekend roundup. But first, the results in Wisconsin. Not very surprising, but significant. First on the Republicans, CBS News correspondent Major Garrett.
Donald Trump misread Wisconsin voters badly, predicting victory when all credible evidence pointed to defeat. As the hunt for delegates intensifies, the GOP frontrunner is on something of a losing streak. For his part, Ted Cruz described his victory as a turning point and said it proves Trump is no longer, if he ever was, the inevitable nominee.
God bless the great state of Wisconsin.
Ted Cruz added a big Wisconsin victory to a recent sweep of delegate gains.
When Colorado and Wyoming finish voting, we are likely to have gained over 100 delegates on Donald Trump.
Cruz vowed he would win the GOP nomination outright.
Either before Cleveland or at the convention in Cleveland, together we will win a majority of the delegates.
Donald Trump campaigned outside Milwaukee early on Election Day.
I hear the polls are busy, huh?
They are busy.
We could have a big surprise tonight, folks.
But left town before the polls closed, issuing only this defiant statement, arguing that Cruz is worse than a puppet. He is a Trojan horse being used by the party bosses to steal the nomination. More than one in three Republican voters said they'd be scared if Trump were elected president, according to CBS News exit polls, while more than 70% of Trump supporters said they'd back a third-party candidate if Cruz won the nomination.
That from CBS's Major Garrett. Donald Trump, to boost his chance of winning the nomination, even if he doesn't get the required 1,237 delegates before the party convention, in effect said, "You're hired," to Paul Manafort. Manafort is a veteran of Republican convention delegate competition, wooing them to support Trump if they're not absolutely bound by state law or party regulations on the first ballot at the convention, or to shift to Donald Trump, not away from him, if there's a second ballot. CBS News political editor Steve Chigaris on Trump and his few advisors.
I think there's a realization that he's losing this delegate fight, that they had to do a little bit more than this really small campaign staff they put together. Small and fairly inexperienced, I should say. So they're bringing in people like Paul Manafort, who's been around for decades in Washington and around presidential campaigns, to help shore that up.
Now let's look at the two Democrats running for president. By now, in April, Hillary Clinton must have been hoping that Bernie Sanders would have dropped out, but he keeps raising money and drawing big crowds. We have two reports by CBS's Nancy Cordes, first on the Sanders victory this past Tuesday.
Let me take this opportunity to thank the people of Wisconsin.
The Democratic underdog overachieved in the Badger state and said it's a sign of things to come.
We have a path toward victory, a path toward the White House.
Sanders does have a path, but it's a steep one. He picked up roughly 14 more delegates than Clinton, but he still trails her by 692 when you factor in superdelegates. And the next big state to vote,
thank you so much,
is the one she represented in the Senate.
The values of New York are the values of America.
Still, the Wisconsin loss stings. Clinton lost men by nearly 30 points. She lost 8 in 10 voters under 30. And she also lost 8 in 10 voters who said honesty was the most important quality in a candidate.
As the rhetoric became heated, mostly in New York ahead of the April 19th primary there, Nancy Cordes reported on Friday morning.
Tensions are high ahead of big Democratic contests in New York and Pennsylvania, where 436 delegates are at stake. Clinton needs just 635 delegates to lock up the nomination.
What's your name?
She reminded New York voters of her hometown credentials Thursday with a ride on the subway, traveling 9 blocks on the 4 train in the Bronx.
So convenient.
Things got heated in Philadelphia, where former President Bill Clinton was campaigning for her. He took on 2 demonstrators who were protesting his wife's use of the term super predators to describe gang members in a 1996 speech.
I don't know how you would characterize the gang leaders who got 13-year-old kids hopped up on crack and sent them out onto the street to murder other African-American children. Maybe you thought they were good citizens. She didn't. She didn't. You are defending the people who kill the lives you say matter. Tell the truth.
Hillary Clinton has apologized for using the term super predator, but it is still a sticking point for some African-Americans who believe the 1990s crime bill she was defending contributed to mass incarcerations.
That from Nancy Cordes in New York on Friday. CBS News political director John Dickerson spoke with correspondent Steve Kathan about the Wisconsin wins for Cruz and Sanders. First, about Senator Sanders.
He has all kinds of momentum. He needs that going into the states that are coming up, which are more favorable to Hillary Clinton, raises questions about the kind of weaknesses of her campaign. For Donald Trump, it means the hill is steeper that he has to climb to get the delegates before the nomination. And it means the Stop Trump forces, which include Ted Cruz, are feeling pretty good and that they might actually be able to do something.
With New York and Pennsylvania ahead, is that really possible?
So it depends on a number of things. A, whether Cruz can get some purchase in 2 states that are not his kind of states, where their electorate's more moderate. Also, it depends on what John Kasich does. John Kasich, in one scenario, could actually pull delegates away from Trump. But if he's in competition with Cruz, because of the way the delegates are apportioned, he can actually weaken Cruz's ability to pull delegates away from Trump. So we'll have to see how it plays out.
And for the Democrats, Clinton, as you say, has had several losses in a row, still a big delegate lead. But for her campaign, there has to be frustration that this is still a fight. As she tries to turn the conversation more to Trump, she still has to deal with this.
She still has to deal with Bernie Sanders, and she still has to deal with all the nagging questions which irritate her about, you know, well, voters don't find you honest and trustworthy. Why is that? That's a very hard question to answer. It's an invitation to 2 unpleasant things. 1, a series of questions about all of your weaknesses, and 2, a lot of suggestions from well-meaning people, but nevertheless, a lot of suggestions from people about things that you should change as a candidate. And that's irritating in part because you don't know which one to pick, and you also, it takes you off your game.
Next, Bob Schieffer, and later, discrimination against gay people legalized in some states.
Stay with us on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Once again, here's Dan Revie.
As the battle between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton got more bitter, Sanders was on the CBS Evening News on Thursday, anchored that day by Charlie Rose, explaining why he had said that Clinton is not qualified to be president. Earlier, he'd explained he said that primarily because she voted for the invasion of Iraq.
I have tried to run an issue-oriented campaign, which is what I believe the American people want to hear. They want to hear about what ideas we have to improve their lives, not just attacking each other every day. We are getting attacked every single day by the Clinton campaign. I want them to know we are going to respond in kind, but I hope that we do not have that kind of
thing. Do you believe Secretary Clinton is unqualified to be president?
Well, does Secretary Clinton believe that I am unqualified to be president?
But why can't you simply say yes?
She has years of experience. She is extremely intelligent.
So why can't you say?
I have some experience, too. I have a pretty good record in Congress as a senator, as a mayor. I think I am qualified.
Eventually, Sanders said he was responding to a Washington Post headline that reported Clinton had described him as unqualified. But Sanders told Charlie Rose he'd like this personal squabble to end.
If Hillary Clinton is the nominee, you will be supporting her.
I think the idea of a Donald Trump or a Ted Cruz presidency would be an unmitigated disaster for this country. And if Secretary Clinton is the nominee, I will certainly support her.
But a Quinnipiac poll found that 25% of Sanders supporters claim they would not vote for Clinton in November. In that poll, Sanders leads Clinton nationwide among Democrats and independents who lean toward the Democrats, 49-47%. Add all that to the talk about an open convention for the Republicans in July. That would happen if Donald Trump fails to win all the delegates he'd need to lock up the nomination. And you get CBS's Bob Schieffer telling the anchors of CBS This Morning.
I'm beginning to wonder, are these political parties going to survive 2016? I think the Republicans, I mean, I don't know who's going to get this nomination. I don't know if it's going to wind up in Cleveland. If it does, Donald Trump is not going quietly into the night. I think that's one thing we can say for sure. I don't know who's going to get the nomination, but there's going to be a huge fight out there. We may be seeing, for the Republicans, something like the Democrats saw in 1968 in Chicago, where the party simply tore itself apart in full view of the entire nation on television. You know, there were riots in the streets. There was brutality by the police and all of that. And they not only lost in 1968, they come back in 1972. They wind up nominating George McGovern, a good man, but someone far outside the mainstream of the Democratic Party, and he lost in a historic landslide, carried only the state of Massachusetts. Is this what's shaping up here for the Republicans?
Donald Trump is certainly sending out signals that he thinks they're trying to take it away from him. What's more risky, do you think, for the party? Donald Trump is a nominee where people say they're afraid, or alienating his supporters?
Well, I don't think it's good either way. I mean, either way you do it. I mean, let's say he runs as a third-party candidate. I don't think he could be elected, but I don't think the Republican candidate could be elected either, if that's the case. Let's say he is the candidate, and with the numbers that he's running up, the negatives he has among just women voters, I think it's going to be very, very difficult for Republicans. But then you go to the other side here, and let's talk about the Democrats. I don't think this is their finest hour either as a party. I mean, here you have the oldest party in America has managed to come up with one candidate who's a Democrat. And she's having a fight of her life with someone who's never sought office as a Democrat, who's an avowed socialist.
And
I don't know what's
likely to stay
here.
In because he's got plenty of money.
Well, exactly. I mean, you're talking about how long can he stay? He's certainly not embarrassing himself because he's winning.
Yeah.
No one would blame him for just hanging around to see if Hillary Clinton's going to be indicted.
Bob Schieffer with Gail King, Nora O'Donnell, and Charlie Rose on CBS This Morning. When it comes to discrimination against gay and transgender people, controversy has spread to yet another southern state, as North Carolina is joined by Mississippi in letting discriminators claim Bible-based motives. CBS's Mark Strassman in Mississippi.
Its new so-called religious freedom law allows business people and government workers to deny services based on their religious beliefs. The law applies to marriage licenses, jobs, housing, even an employer's dress code, and prevents state government from intervening once religious beliefs are the reason given. Governor Phil Bryant signed it into law.
I think it protects the religious freedom of people who have deeply held religious beliefs, and so did the legislature and so did the majority of the people of the state of Mississippi, so we signed it into law.
A recent poll indicated nearly two-thirds of Mississippians support the new law. Pentecostal pastor David Tipton is one of them.
We should be able to freely express our religious views and live by our conscience.
Including who you do business with.
Certainly.
Gay rights advocates were outraged. One tweeted that Mississippi had enacted the most toxic anti-LGBT law ever. Mitchell Moore owns Campbell's Bakery in downtown Jackson.
Gay couple walks in your bakery. They want a wedding cake.
I sell them a wedding cake. It's what I do. We sell cakes.
This 43-year-old registered Republican calls the law a big mistake.
I am a Christian, but I don't think that Christianity tells me that I have to discriminate against people. In fact, I'm here to serve people, not to turn them away.
A bakery owner in Jackson, Mississippi, some businesses have a sticker on their front door that says, "We don't discriminate." President Obama's nominee to the ninth seat on the Supreme Court has had some meetings with senators, including Republicans, though their leadership still insists that Merrick Garland will not be questioned at hearings and there won't be a vote. Meantime, Monday, there was an 8-0 ruling reported by CBS's Barry Bagnato.
The justices unanimously are refusing to allow voting districts to be devised based on the number of eligible voters rather than on total population. Supporters of a change argued that illegal immigrants are diluting the representation of people who participate in elections, especially in places such as Texas. CBS News senior legal analyst Andrew Cohen.
The court refused to adopt a new rule that would have dramatically altered the landscape of redistricting.
If it hadn't, large groups would have been left with no voice, says Danielle Lang at the Campaign Legal Center.
Children, non-citizens, the disabled.
Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg says the Constitution's framers intended representatives to serve all residents. Barry Bagnato, CBS News, Washington.
Now to Southern Europe. The number of migrants arriving from the sea, from Syria and other troubled nations, has fallen sharply because of the agreement that any who reach Greece will be locked up, then shipped to Turkey. On the Greek island of Lesbos, reporter Nick Barnett's on Monday.
The first deportations of migrants back to Turkey began in the early morning hours. Two tourist boats chartered by Frontex left the port of Mytilene and another from the island of Chios, bringing 202 migrants, mostly of Pakistani descent, to the Turkish port of Dikili. It's the first major test of a deal between the EU and Turkey to stem the flow of migrants and refugees into Greece, which has seen over 1 million land on its shores since the beginning of 2015.
Up next, Belgium almost desperate to find an ISIS bomber, then Ken Burns on his new documentary. It's about baseball, Jackie Robinson, and race.
Stay with us on the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
Hello, I'm Jerry Mathers. I was the Beaver in Leave It to Beaver. And 20 years ago, I almost died from type 2 diabetes. When I was diagnosed with type 2, I was shocked. My blood sugar was through the roof. Now, the very same natural remedies I use to control my type 2 diabetes are available for you in a super easy program called the Diabetes Solution Kit. And I should know it works. I use the very same techniques to drop 40 pounds of fat, get my blood sugar under control, and watch my type 2 diabetes fade into thin air. If you have diabetes, I urge you to try this step-by-step plan. It has all the natural techniques I used, and it works a lot faster, too. I'm Jerry Mathers, and if I can do it, you can do it, too.
If you'd like to normalize your blood sugar and stop taking your diabetes medication completely with your doctor's approval, go to diabetic44.com. That's diabetic44.com. Reverse your diabetes in as little as 30 days by going to diabetic44.com. That's diabetic44.com now.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Once again, here's correspondent Dan Revie.
Belgium and France, working together trying to smash ISIS terrorist cells, made more arrests this past week after the massacres in Paris this past November, then the killing of more than 30 people in Brussels less than 3 weeks ago. A gang of three at Brussels airport were seen pushing heavy suitcases on luggage carts to set off large bombs. The third man, who wore a hat and probably a disguise, got away. CBS News reporter Terry Schultz picks up the story.
Ever since he was first shown in surveillance video shortly after the airport attacks, the third man, or the man in the hat, was the subject of intense speculation and searching. In an appeal for the public's help, police released a dramatic video showing the suspect wearing a light-colored jacket jogging away from the airport in the seconds after his two accomplices blew themselves up inside.
Une fois les bombes explosées à 7h58, l'homme à la veste claire et au chapeau est sorti du bâtiment.
Thanks to security camera footage, investigators knew the path he took on foot from the airport, walking almost 2 hours into central Brussels near the area of the metro that had also, in the meantime, been bombed by one of the airport assailants' brothers.
Il a poursuivi sa route sur la chaussée de Louvain où il est filmé à 9h49.
But then the suspect disappeared. Along the way, he discarded his light-colored jacket, and investigators appealed for anyone who might have found that or have any other information to contact them. For the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
Now to one of America's most important baseball players ever.
Baseball refreshing itself once more.
When the seasons changed in April 1947, baseball and the country began to change as well. Jackie Robinson, number 42, made his debut with the Brooklyn Dodgers, the sole black man in an all-white league.
That was CBS's Susan Spencer reporting more than six decades later on how Jackie Robinson made history in 1947, the first black player in the major leagues. And after he retired in 1957, he was a civil rights leader. Filmmaker Ken Burns and his team have made a new documentary about Robinson and how he changed this country. The title is Jackie Robinson, this coming week on public TV, in two parts, each 2 hours. Ken Burns spoke with CBS News correspondent Steve Futterman on the significance of integrating Major League Baseball.
On April 15, 1947, when Jackie Robinson walked out to play first base on Ebbets Field, Martin Luther King was a junior at Morehouse College. Truman hadn't integrated the military yet. Brown versus Board of Education happened. There hadn't been lunch counter sit-ins. There hadn't been Rosa Parks refusing to give up her seat. This is the beginning of the first real progress in civil rights since our Civil War.
If he hadn't been there, was there going to be another person who led the way?
There were other people that were qualified to do it, but now in retrospect, you begin to realize probably only one person could have stood the abuse and held his head high. Probably one person could have done this, and that was Jackie Robinson, and it cost him. Heroism is not without its sacrifice. And Jackie Robinson, if you think of the oldest picture of him, he looks stooped, he looks old, white-haired, like he's 85 years old. He died at 53. Like Atlas, he had borne the world of his people on his shoulders and done it magnificently and didn't stop doing it when baseball was over. That's the little-known story that our film will also tell of him as a principal civil rights leader. Martin Luther King said he was a sit-inner before sit-ins, a freedom rider before freedom riders. Jackie walked through the door first.
What do you hope the country, the people who view this, get out? What message do you want? Because you are an investigator, a journalist, a filmmaker, but you're also, I think, an advocate. What do you want to come out of this?
If you accept just hypothetically that my belief that this is one of the most important human beings in all of American history, then I think we would present this as state's evidence A of how extraordinary this man is. It comes back to us. I mean, he challenged us all his life to be better. I think this film will wake people up. I think there are kids out there, but I think there are also adults who will go, my goodness, this is what it's about. It's about making a difference. It's about doing the right thing. And Jackie did that all his life.
Speaking to CBS's Steve Futterman, that's Ken Burns. His documentary on Jackie Robinson premieres on PBS this Monday and Tuesday nights. One of the greats of country music will sing no more. Merle Haggard died on his 79th birthday at his home in rural Northern California. He had pneumonia. You may recall that he spoke and sang about his prison experiences. He served time for robbery. He started performing with a prison band. In 1972, then-Governor Ronald Reagan granted Haggard a full pardon. Soon after that, he was greeted in the White House by President Richard Nixon. We have more from CBS News correspondent Jim Taylor.
Music would be the key to turning his life around.
I'm on the run. The highway is my home.
The Fugitive in 1966 became the first of Haggard's many number one hits. Its simple narrative, honky-tonk rhythm, and no bull honesty typified his style.
We don't smoke marijuana in Muskogee.
Okie from Muskogee, written as a joke, nevertheless saluted his working-class values, while
'cause you take me for granted
was musical heartbreak, crooned by a man who would marry five times. Few country artists could match Haggard's skills as a performer and songwriter, or his output of more than 70 albums. No wonder that even in his lifetime, Merle Haggard was hailed as a legend. Jim Taylor, CBS News.
The winner of American Idol, and we mean the last American Idol, was Trent Harmon. The 25-year-old from Mississippi bursting into tears, seen live on Fox TV. And that marked the end of 15 years for that TV series. CBS News correspondent Vladimir Dutier looks back.
When American Idol premiered in the summer of 2002, singers often went off key.
Bad, mountain high enough.
And performances weren't always in sync with the judges.
I made it through the wilderness.
I've never, ever heard anything like that in my life.
Keith, that was horrific, man.
But the show's timing couldn't have been better.
This arrived at the exact right moment, not just a diminishing time of power for labels, but an increasing time of power for reality television.
Joe Levy is a contributing editor at Rolling Stone.
Did record executives, were they caught off guard by
the
success?
Oh, God, yeah. Record executives, nobody took this seriously.
And even when I won, I mean, who knew that something would come out of it, you know?
Since winning American Idol's first season, Kelly Clarkson recorded 7 albums and won 3 Grammys. She recently talked to Gayle King about the show's unexpected impact on her career.
My goal was just to find somebody, like maybe they heard me singing on the show and somebody would want to manage me or help me. Like, I just wanted to sing.
The show hit its peak in 2007.
You're my girl!
The same year, a young Justin Bieber was discovered on YouTube.
All of a sudden, people have another way of gathering millions of eyeballs for their good and bad singing.
The show's influence on record sales also waned. Winners from the last three seasons selling just over 100,000 albums combined.
Please follow us on Twitter for the latest headlines at CBS Radio News. And I'm at Dan Raviv.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup, a wrap-up of the week with the correspondents who cover the news. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Once again, here's correspondent Dan Raviv.
Some are calling this the biggest leak of all time. More than 11 million pages from the files of a law firm in Panama, which advises clients on setting up anonymous accounts and corporations. ICIJ, the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, has a team going through all those pages, so far finding links with people close to Russia's President Putin, also the Prime Minister of Iceland, who as a result is being forced out of office, and others, though at least in the first few days of revelations, no Americans. U.S. experts explain that an American can create a shell corporation and be anonymous in Delaware or Nevada. Of course, the company and the individual do have to pay taxes on any dividends, interest, and income. More from CBS News correspondent Don Daler.
It's not illegal to have an offshore company, but one purpose of a so-called shell company is that the money put in it can't be traced to its owner. The practice allows people to hold cash and move cash under a corporate name without international law enforcement or tax authorities knowing who it belongs to.
An anonymous source provided nearly 40 years' worth of documents from a law firm in Panama named Mossack Fonseca, which helps establish offshore bank accounts for the world's wealthiest people. The 2.6 terabytes of data handed over to journalists reportedly contains approximately 11.5 million documents, including nearly 5 million internal emails, providing a window into some 214,000 companies.
This really told us something about how the offshore financial system works, and especially about who are the kinds of people who are using it.
Michael Hudson is one of hundreds of journalists who researched the documents in what's likely the biggest leak of inside information in history.
The same system that politicians and the mega wealthy and billionaires are using to move money and do transactions is also being used by criminals, Ponzi schemers, drug kingpins, you name it, to hide their corrupt businesses.
Among the 12 current or former heads of state named in the investigations, the presidents of Ukraine and Argentina, and the king of Saudi Arabia. And while he is not named directly, the documents show allies to Russian President Vladimir Putin secretly shuffled as much as $2 billion through banks and shadow companies.
In Moscow, President Putin said the alleged leak is an attempt by Western countries to destabilize Russia. In Britain, a confession. Details from CBS News reporter Larry Miller.
British Prime Minister David Cameron first denied any link to an offshore trust set up by his late father, named in the so-called Panama Papers, but now admits he and his wife have financially benefited.
So I did own stocks and shares in the past.
But Cameron insists he sold all his shares before becoming Prime Minister.
I've been very clear about the future. I've said I'm not going to benefit from any family trust.
The opposition Labour Party now wants the Prime Minister to publish his tax returns. Larry Miller, CBS News, London.
We turn to a lawyer in New York, Terrence Oved. Your law firm advises high-wealth clients, some of them not Americans, on real estate. Some senators have demanded that the U.S. government quickly find out if U.S. taxpayers have secret accounts that are in these files from Panama. But if the holdings are disclosed, Mr. Oved, and U.S. taxes are paid, it's not illegal.
That's 100% correct. Nothing is prohibited. It's the disclosure. If you have your accountants and you see a lot of these where, you know, they're reporting them and they're above board and at the end of the day no tax is due, the whole question here is disclosure. And if at the end of the day, from making that disclosure, these are amounts that tax is due on and payable on and you haven't paid it, That's when the offense happens.
The Obama administration says it wants more disclosure in international finance. And for instance, for people who buy an apartment over a certain amount, if it's bought through a company, the owner of the company must be disclosed. What's that apartment value?
It's over $3 million in New York City. So, for example, in Manhattan, if you're purchasing an apartment for $3 million or more, you'd have to make that disclosure.
It used to be that an LLC, a corporation, might buy it. Often that was a foreign person. So what's the IRS's interest? Just for example, a fellow in Bulgaria owns a company. His company buys the apartment. Why does the IRS want to know about the person from Bulgaria?
The IRS is concerned, according to them, about the possibility that dirty money is being put into luxury real estate. They want to be sure that at the end of the day, these entities are not being used to nefariously hide funds of individuals that otherwise wouldn't be disclosed and we wouldn't know who they are.
That's Terrence Oved, who works on real estate with the law firm Oved & Oved. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This past week, the Treasury Department changed some rules to make it less attractive for American corporations to merge with foreign companies. The goal in those so-called inversions is to reduce greatly the amount of tax paid to the U.S. That change was enough for Pfizer, the big American drug company, to cancel its merger with Allergan, the maker of Botox, which has its headquarters officially in Ireland. Now a heroic woman severely injured in the Boston Marathon bombing 3 years ago who plans to run the marathon on April 18th, a week from Monday. Adrienne Haslett Davis lost her left leg below the knee. She had been a ballroom dancer and a dance instructor. She'll be running the marathon in part to support a group that provides prosthetics. It's called Limbs for Life. Adrienne Haslett Davis spoke with CBS's Nora O'Donnell as they jogged together.
The milestones that you've made running.
Yeah.
What has that meant?
Gosh, it's meant the world to me. Like, I can run. I'm so fast.
So you're going to run the Boston Marathon?
I am.
Are you a runner?
I am now. Running for me was like torture. I would run a block and be winded and feel like I was going to die.
And now you're missing part of your leg and you're running a marathon.
Yeah. It's bizarre.
So we're here on Boylston Street.
We are.
Where the finish line is.
Yeah. And birds are chirping. It's a beautiful day. It's very similar to that day.
She stood on this very street nearly 3 years ago, watching runners as they crossed the finish line. Adrienne would not be able to walk away. After her lower leg was amputated, Adrienne began a long and difficult recovery.
And how has your life changed?
Every way possible. I look at life so much differently now. I'm more patient with people. I didn't think I was impatient before, but I'm more patient with people.
Are you still angry?
Yeah, I am. I've learned that running really helps out with that in a good way. But I believe in feeling every single bit of that and not burying it so that you can really enjoy the good days.
I like that you've said, my life is not going to be defined by what has happened to me.
Yeah, I want my life to be defined by how I live it. I'm not just an amputee. I'm not just a marathon survivor. You know, none of us are. And I think it's important to always remember how far you've come as well, because I have days where I think I haven't come that far at all, which sounds crazy to say, but you get in these mindsets, and it's important to see, you know, to see how far you've come.
Speaking with CBS's Nora O'Donnell in Boston, Adrienne Haslett Davis is 35 years old. She's separated now from her husband, an Air Force man, who was also wounded in the marathon bombing. Coming next, a different response to tragedy. A parent who lost his son writes a novel about grieving, and it's now also a play.
Stay with us on the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
Listen to the news right now in your car with the CBS Radio News app. Just download our free app to your iOS or Android device to stream the news you need on Apple CarPlay or Android Auto. Listen to the latest news right now or to your favorites like Face the Nation and the Weekend Roundup. The CBS Radio News app. Download it on your phone now to use in Apple CarPlay and Android Auto today.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Once again, here's correspondent Dan Raviv.
Now a highly successful novelist from Israel, David Grossman, visiting here in Washington, D.C., where one of his books, Falling Out of Time, has been turned into a play. It portrays people we don't know where they are grieving, we learn, for their dead children. David Grossman's son was killed as an Israeli soldier in the war near the Lebanese border 10 years ago. Why isn't it set in Israel like your other books?
As you said, Dan, it's a universal topic. I wrote about life after a loss and a loss of a child, which is something that our family has experienced. We lost our son, Uri. And after he fell, I started to feel that I need to find my own words in order to describe what I feel.
Was that in any way because of the messages that you got? I mean, I can imagine you got condolence messages from writers and others all around the world. And how did those messages make you feel?
Many of those letters of condolences, they spoke in the same voice, as if someone has dictated the writing to the writers. They said, we are speechless. There are no words to describe it. And I also knew this feeling, you know, because in the beginning I did not want to write and I did not want to talk about it. It takes time to absorb the overwhelming sensation that one feels. And then later I started to feel that if I do not have the words, my, so to say, inner channels to my son and to these facts of death, those channels are being blocked gradually, and I wanted to keep them open.
So you had to find the words. But by the way, did you feel that the death of your son in military service was unique, or you had to make it unique? Because again, I imagine the condolence messages were not unique. Those emails were the same no matter whom they were writing to. Did you have to make it special?
No, I did not feel that I have to make it special. But of course, for me, it was the major fact of my life and in the life of my family. And I felt that I needed to, first of all, to redeem his death from the kind of national death that every soldier experiences. You know, every soldier who dies at war, the country tries immediately to glorify him, maybe because the country feels a little guilty for not preventing this death. And the more she feels guilty, the more that the country, you know, elaborates and pump up the heroism and the comradeship of the soldiers. And I wanted to redeem my private son and to tell about this predicament of grieving, which is the most isolating human predicament, no matter how much the whole family is a loving family and supporting family, yet you are always alone in your grieving.
Well, that comes across in Falling Out of Time, your novel, now adapted into a play. And I'm struck by this. Early in the play, the audience may not know what the tragedy is. What are these nine people just starting to talk about? Especially the first character, a man who talks about going there. Does that reflect how you felt, that in some way you wanted to go to wherever your boy was?
There was this instinct to get as far as possible to the place where the living can still feel something of the dead one.
That suggests an intersection, and the play does too, even as eventually all the characters are talking and walking and talking about it. And then we understand that they are going through grief. They seem to be suggesting they want to touch it. They'll understand death better if they can somehow confront the person who's no longer there. Do you see that as one of the approaches, or almost your recipe for getting through this?
No, there is no recipe at all, and everyone should and can do it in his or her own way. And I needed to give my own words. I remember I told my wife, if we were so unfortunate to be sent into this island of exile, and grief is an island of exile, at least I will try to map it with my own words, to give it my own words.
David, because I know that you're from the Middle East, specifically Israel, I couldn't help thinking during the play about all the children who've been dying. Now, in the Syrian civil war, worst of all in the last 5 years, but also the people in Palestine and Israel, your country, children dying, not just a statistic.
It is our reality. You mentioned statistics and death, and I immediately thought of something that Stalin said. One death is a tragedy. Million deaths are statistics. And I think that literature or art in general, they are maybe the best way to redeem the tragedy of the individual from this statistic of the masses.
Americans can understand that too, whether it's the cities where children have been dying of either starvation or police violence. Well, as you say, David, it's universal.
It is universal. We all experience it. And it's a kind of a major test for us as human beings. How do we stand in front of such a devastating loss? Do we surrender to it? Do we become apathetic? Do we allow the catastrophe to make us real victims of it? Or do we find in us the power to make something significant out of it?
That's David Grossman. Your novel is called Falling Out of Time. That's also the name of a play now in Washington, D.C. As you hear, it's about dealing with grief. It's not about Israel. The whole goal is to be universal. David Grossman, thanks very much.
Thank you, Dan.
Now a death during a globe-circling yacht race, which began in August and takes a full year, scheduled as 14 separate races. On the ninth leg, a British woman was swept off the deck by high waves. CBS News reporter Larry Miller has details.
British amateur sailor Sarah Young was buried at sea after being washed overboard in the Pacific during the Clipper Around the World yacht race. Her boat was heading to Seattle. The crew pulled her from the ocean but couldn't save her. It's not known why the 40-year-old wasn't tethered to the boat with safety straps. Race founder Robin Knox Johnston.
The essence of good seamanship is safety, and she wasn't clipped on, and I need to know why she wasn't.
Before Sarah Young was buried at sea, the crew recited prayers and poetry and sang, then held a minute's silence for their friend. Larry Miller, CBS News, London.
12 yachts take part in that round-the-world race. Only one other competitor has died, a British man who was on the same yacht as Sarah Young. Now to end on a lighter note, our Weekend Roundup commentator, Charles Grodin.
Maybe it's happened before, but I don't remember seeing young children sitting in the front row behind a political candidate at a rally. I assume to show the candidate cares about kids. The children look either bored or confused as to why they're there. One was looking at an iPad or taking a selfie. Politics. I'm Charles Grodin for the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
Thanks for being with us, and anytime you want to hear us, please do a web search for CBS Weekend Roundup. You'll find our podcasts also on iTunes and other podcast services, and our app for your smartphone is CBS Radio News. I'm Dan Revie. Bye.
You've been listening to the CBS News Weekend Roundup. The program is produced in the Washington Bureau of CBS News. The executive producer is Howard Arenstein.